Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah. Today in the studio with me, I was super excited to have Andrea Gurnari. Andrea is a partner at 2100 Ventures, a pre-seed and seed stage fund dedicated to supporting European entrepreneurs driving the new golden age of industrial innovation, investing in B2B businesses across a range of verticals. Prior to 2100 Ventures, Andrea was an investor with Atomico and Connect Ventures, before which he worked in and co-founded startups in Italy and the UK. In today's episode, we talk about how early founders should be thinking about monetization, the collaborative and international nature of the UK, and why that's a huge advantage for the country, how the psychology of the founder impacts the decision-making, and accepting that the experiment hasn't worked can be very difficult, why founders need deep intellectual honesty, how the ecosystem owes it to founders to not demonize failure, why everything starts with experiments, and how understanding the relativity between ecosystems is important for founders. We also touched on whether or not we can innovate on the old economy of Europe and rebuild the productivity the region has lost. And Andrea's contrarian take, sometimes you have to judge the reasoning, not the output. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Andrea, really great to have you in the studio with me today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for the invite. Pleasure to be here.
No worries at all. Well, let's get straight into it. So look, talk me through why, as an Italian co-founder, you ended up moving to the UK with your hardware startup back in the early 2010s rather than building in Italy. What is it about the UK that gave it the edge, in your opinion, over other regions?
Yeah. When the way basically I actually came to build a company with the other co-founders, it was a hardware company at the time. There was definitely a strong technological component. The way actually I got in touch with them was in Manchester. So I was in the UK right after graduation, or right actually before graduating, for an event in Manchester, and I got to meet them, right? And I naturally found something which I, in my career, found multiple times, which was essentially meeting people that had amazing ideas, very technical, very deep in the way they were kind of like pitching the solution and so on and so forth, but kind of like really wanted to really had challenges in basically bringing that to market and taking that to market. And there's always a component of, I have something like this, right? How do I go to market? How do I actually monetize that? But some of them don't even think about monetization, right? They basically are so happy about the idea that they had, that it's sometimes difficult to actually think about ways to actually bring that to market or to even productize this. I think this is one important point, one keyword is productize here. So I talked to them and they were pitching me through the idea and I was like, guys, this is great. I think we definitely have something here that we can work with. How are you planning to monetize that? And there was silence there, right? And at that point I said, okay, there's clear opportunity here. I don't want to sound cynical at all, but let's be strategic about the way we actually take this to market. So we basically went out and did a market analysis. And the tool at the time was, it was a smartphone charger. It was back in 2010. So it was a very simple idea in terms of taking that to market. But it had to be a bit more strategic in the way, or be kind of like creative in the way we would take this to market. And so by doing an analysis, it came clear that a huge kind of like aspect of the social life in the UK was actually hanging out, and most of the times after work. There's also the concept of that in Italy, for sure, with the aperitivo concept. But
it's a little less formal. In Italy, like the aperitivo, you go, you have a couple of drinks, you have some sort of snacks, yeah. But it's a very social event, kind of stood up, wandering around, whereas I guess in the UK, you're sat in a pub having drinks,
exactly. Yeah. In the UK, what we found out was that there were natural network effects, mm-hmm. In that people were hanging out in specific circles and specific centers where we could easily sell product into. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it was so much ingrained into the timing they would take for them to spend time in the pub that was perfectly, like the perfect market for that. So by being very cynical in the approach and being very strategic, we said this company needs to actually be built with a view on going to market. Now, the challenges were that from a technological perspective, this is something that the UK, I think, saw earlier than many other ecosystems, there was an opportunity to attract talent from outside. So one thing that we did at the time was essentially applying for this program that at the time the UK Trade and Investment Office was running, which was essentially aimed at bringing entrepreneurs from all over the world to the UK. And I think this is, again, we can... I'd love to tell you about and to talk about the transformation that I've seen in the UK over the last 10 years.
I'd love to hear that. Yeah, yeah.
But as a founder, as an, you know, as an expat kind of like settling in the UK. But I would say it was definitely the most interesting thing was we would basically be put in the same room with many other entrepreneurs coming from New Zealand at the time, France, and so on and so forth, to bring something and to build something in the UK. That was the condition. And also facilitated fundraising. And so all of a sudden... when you are a founder, you find yourself not thinking too much about how things are, you know, things are happening so fast that you're basically just navigating whatever is happening, right? It's just a wave and you just, you know, either learn how to surf as you go through it or you basically go
crash and burn,
right? Exactly. So we never thought about that, right? But we were like, there is this opportunity. The technology is pretty scalable. So there's a chance for us to just basically build it, you know, outside of Italy. Why not taking it when it comes with capital, when it comes to access and so on and so forth? And so we basically naturally sat down and said, why not, essentially? And so, I mean, that kind of like led to participation to the program, the fundraising and so on and so forth. So it was, I mean, I would say a natural kind of like trajectory that led me to the UK. I knew already the market a bit because I spent a lot of time here before starting the company. So I knew a bit about the ecosystem. And it was another component which I would... definitely point out now, it's the excitement. Like, I think when you're a founder, you're basically in a huge party where the music is just kind of like very loud and you just go on with the flow. And when you were coming to the UK in 2010, 2009, 2011 with the Olympics, there was a level of excitement that I've never found again in an ecosystem. Probably now I see, you know, in France with AI, but it was just like probably even more because it was driven by the community. And so everybody wanted to build stuff and so on. You know, it could be similar to the Bay Area probably. But so, yeah, there was also a willingness to build in the UK and to be part of that ecosystem.
It's interesting because I was abroad during that period and we were considering coming back to the UK, and exactly as you say, kind of like post the global financial crisis, 2008, 2009, things were felt like bad. Like they, you know, things were difficult. By the time it was like 2012, 13, things felt like they'd really kind of lifted up and there was this huge positivity, I guess. Not that I was in any way, shape or form involved with the kind of tech ecosystem at that time, but you could feel that sort of enthusiasm. London was coming back. The UK was kind of coming back. It was a shame that, you know, two or three years after that kind of various decisions happened, which I would argue have not helped and maybe dampened some of that enthusiasm. But I completely get it. In that period, it was kind of, you know, mobile phones had come out in 2007, or certainly, sorry, not mobile phones, but iPhone had come out in 2007. That whole platform shift was there. Software was becoming kind of a thing in the UK that it hadn't been in the past. And, you know, you were seeing the startup hub, Silicon Roundabout, Google's, you know, Google Campus, all of those things kind of coming up. And there was this real sense of community and collaboration and that international kind of spirit that the UK and certainly London has always had, I think all kind of goes to that. I think, you know, the fact that you'd studied here also helps you know mm-hmm. It wasn't that you needed to make the decision to move from Italy. You kind of already figured out, you know, the lay of the land more generally, and the reality is though you built that business for a couple of years before making the decision to return capital back to your investors. So can you talk me through that thought process then, because I expect there are a number of founders today who are grappling with similar decisions given the current fundraising environment and just the overall sort of state of the ecosystem. So what advice would you have for them as they try to decide what the best course of action, like how should they think through you know, should I carry on or, is it time to draw a line?
I think it varies a lot based on the psychology of the founder and the way one approaches the decision to build things, right? And what I've realized now is that I was seeing things from a founder perspective back then, and now I'm also integrating that with the investor perspective, right? So now as an investor, when I give and when we decide to invest on a founder, I want them to basically go on and experiment, right? So what I'm doing basically is giving them money to have space to experiment. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm doing.
Time, space,
right?
And room to experiment.
Exactly. Yeah. So for me, the most important thing when I, I invest, there's for sure a return component, right? But I think the return component is driven by factors that are so much exogenous to all of this that I never tell them, I always feel that revenues and things that are metrics and so on are a derivative of choices that you take through the experimentation phase. So the more data points you gather, the more you're good at doing and experimenting, the more you can actually see the value of all of that you're doing. So when it comes to answering the question of when is the right time or so on, founders that are very good at experimenting will know the point in which it's time to basically see that the experiment is not working. The most difficult thing for them is accepting or living with the psychological burden of the fact that they took on money and they don't know what to do with that, essentially. And so there's that component which I think is also driven by some investors, where it's better to kind of like continue the process of experimentation, right? Because eventually something will happen, right? You can do that only when you find founders that you really believe have the power of experimenting. Mm-hmm. And so you're basically betting on their power to experiment and keep on experimenting. So it's basically like keeping a plant alive because one day something will happen, right? That's the way, as an investor now, I think about bridges and so on and so forth. It's just a matter of time.
And that's the point though, right? Like there is an unlimited capital for them to experiment. So they've either you as an investor have to believe that they can continue experimenting and that will lead to something, and therefore you will bridge or continue to fund essentially the founder rather than the startup, or the founder has to be of a mindset where irrespective of the funding, they're going to keep pushing through until they find a breakthrough.
The moment, if I have to track it back, basically, when I basically thought that it was better to I would call, shut down the company, return the money to investor, but essentially to say, guys,
It's not working.
It's a moment of deep intellectual honesty where you're like, I've done the experiment. The experiment is not working, and I can easily trace the reason why this is not working, which is very important. You have data points that tell you this is not working, and you feel more intellectually honest to basically go ahead and say, look, there will be another thing, than actually keep on experimenting just because you've been given money to actually keep on experimenting. So this speaks also about the kind of like value of the psychological aspect of the founders and why sometimes when you invest at pre-seed and so on, you give money and you do founder bets because you basically just want them to experiment and come up with results and being data-driven when they do that. And I think that's the way basically I would now suggest even to some founders, be like, I mean, it's a learning process, right? As long as you learn, it'd be fine. But it's not easy because when I've done it and I was 20, I wasn't thinking like that. Mm. It was actually, now I talk, talk about that as if that's, some mature kind of like thought. Back then, it was a very strong psychological burden to bear of accepting failure and so on and so forth. And I've just done it because luckily I found, another job that could kind of like give me a new path. But this speaks about accepting failure as a whole kind of like concept, right? Which I think is something that investors have a strong duty to explain to founders. And even when it comes to the ecosystem and so on, never kind of like, demonizing a founder for the failure or being a bit more interested in why it failed. When I actually meet founders that are repeated founders, like serial founders and so on, even if they haven't been successful, I always ask them, what exactly was the the data point that led you to decide to go on. Because it might be that they found out something during that process that serves them for what they're doing now, right? And so that is something which is a unique insight. Mm-hmm. How you got that unique insight is less important. Mm-hmm. I don't care how you got that unique insight. It's more like you had it, right? And if that kind of like went through, you know, a company that didn't work out, that's totally fine.
Yeah. I mean, one of the, I guess this raises like a really important point, which we've talked about a few times, but I'd love to get your perspective, because I think in the US, that kind of acceptance of failure is ingrained, right? Like there is, you know, there's as much respect for the failed entrepreneur in the US as there is for the successful one. Maybe not quite as much, but like, you know, it depends on who the entrepreneur is, I think. But there is definitely a much more kind of willingness to accept that, that this sort of theory of you are essentially funding a series of bets and experiments, and actually it's a badge of honor to have, you know, raised some money, tried, maybe not quite made it, but at least done it the right way. Versus in the UK, and I would suspect similarly in Europe more broadly, we have a tendency to kind of belittle people that haven't made it, right? So that failure then becomes very burdensome. To your point, the mental health of the founder, you know, potentially of their team, of their family, et cetera, like all comes into play. Because, you know, I've been through the journey of having raised some money, you know, built a, I wouldn't call it a business because it wasn't, you know, trading essentially, but built a product, realized that the product was the wrong product, you know, right product, wrong market, pivoted, but, you know, just didn't have the traction to kind of push forward. And then also realized that maybe I wasn't the right founder to take money and build something. Like it's, you know, in my DNA, I'd rather bootstrap. And actually the kind of conversations I had with some of the investors after that, they were like, yeah, it's fine. Like, you know, you've been absolutely open and honest throughout the whole process. This one didn't work out, right? Like another one might. I think there are investors like that here in the UK, but I think the broader public and some investors penalize that failure quite hard here. And I think it is also one of the reasons why, even though we are seeing growth in the number of sort of founders and startups being built, I think it's probably a limiting factor to the number of founders that we have out here. I mean, how do you see the Europe, like, is Europe, does Europe have a similar mentality, or do you think that acceptance of failure is still?
I think Europe has an even worse mentality when it comes to this.
Yeah.
I think the UK has imported some of the Anglo-Saxon mentality. Well, it hasn't imported, but for sure it has imported some of the US mentality around all of this, which basically allows you to be building the model of a serial entrepreneur, where the series of the ventures and the series of the companies that it's been built, not necessarily actually, you know, have been super successful and so on. Mm. I think in Europe, there's a cultural component related to seeing companies or having a misconception about what it means to build a startup and to build a company and so on and so forth. So the way, going back to my point, the way I think about startups, maybe because I'm investing in pre-seed and seed, so very early stages in which everything needs to be built. I mean, for sure they're building companies, but the way I think about that is essentially labs, right? Now, when you actually have R&Ds into corporates and so on, I mean, you don't shut them down just because they're not coming up with results straight away.
You
right?
often put more you, money in, yeah.
You often put more money in. You often give them space to experiment and so on. You don't conceive them as small companies. It might be, you know, spin-outs. It might be divisions being built and so on and so forth, but it all starts with experiments. So there is for sure a component, like a cultural component in Europe of seeing these companies as kind of like proper kind of like corporates. And therefore, you know, when I think about law, for example, you know, bankruptcy in Italy, I don't know if it's still the case, but it was actually, you know, something which you could go to jail. Mm. So when you think about that, of course, in some cases you were, there's some misconception about the way you actually, you do bankruptcy, right? Which could be that you decide to shut down the company. And in some cases it could be because you've done something legal, but that's always bad, right? But the moment you actually decide that, you know, the company is not there anymore or you want to shut it down, it's not kind of like something that should be penalized per se.
Yeah.
So I think there's for sure a cultural component that not just speaks about the way, you know, companies are dissolved and all these kind of things, but also about how companies are formed.
How they're formed, yeah.
Exactly. Which is something that we've done an investment into a company which we're super excited about that is doing company formation that is coming from the US, as in the founder is a US entrepreneur who built a $1 billion business in the US, and now he's building something very similar in Europe. And we're talking about that with him, about the cultural kind of like different and shift that is seen. And he's, you know, it's pretty clear that for sure challenges in Europe about the way companies are built are not helpful, even in companies that are not built or being dissolved. And so I think it speaks about the whole kind of like range of building companies. When we do investments in Germany, when we do investments in the Netherlands, we do investments across Europe, you see the way rounds are done. And in some cases, it's just easy. You know, in the UK, it's easy to round.
No one wants to invest in Germany because it's a pain.
Germany is a pain. Yeah. There are other countries that are a pain. Italy, from that perspective, can be difficult. And so, you know, even importing like different types of instruments like safes and convertible bonds and so on in kind of like frameworks, like European frameworks, has been pretty tough. Mm. I've seen some efforts, amazing efforts about, you know, making things easier, essentially, to build companies and so on. But we are a long way in Europe to actually get to that stage.
I think the other part there, I wrote about this some months ago, I think in the UK, absolutely, but probably in Europe as well. The way we think about wealth creation is very different, and the way we think about the way we think about wealth is different, right? Like I think in the UK, we have this habit of still being in awe of generational wealth, right? Like so, wealth created 100, 200, 300 years ago and inherited down the piece. And I think in Italy, there's like 30 families or something that hold like 80% of the wealth of Italy or whatever the number is, but it's a crazy sort of metric. Whereas in the US, by the very nature of the fact that the US is a young country, that wealth has been created more recently. And therefore, you know, yes, you have the kind of Boston families and there is an element of that, you know, the blue bloods and so on. But I think it's far more heavily entrenched in the psyche in Europe about, you know, the aristocracy versus kind of the peasant class, if I can call it that, right? And there is this, there's almost a sneering attitude to new wealth, right? Like, so if you created wealth from nothing, there is almost this sort of, you know, looking down your nose where it's not really true wealth because, well, you didn't come from the right family.
I mean, at the end of the day, it all goes back to reading history books and so on. But the way I think about that is, and I was discussing that the other day with probably my partner as well, but so the UK was an empire, right? And when you actually build an empire, everybody is united in the name of what you're building, essentially. So there is richness. There
Common
is for
purpose.
Sure, you know, kind of like wealth and so on, but it's distributed so that everybody is pretty happy. And of course, we're not talking about, you know, the population. We can talk about that discrepancy and so on. Europe, I can talk about Italy because I know a lot about the history of Italy, has never been country until it's been united. It's always been fighting against each other, right? So families fighting against each other has always been the way to go, basically, for these places. That what that created is the concept of social envy, which is basically the more famous you are or the more successful you are, actually not famous but successful, the more you'll be kind of like guessed and doubted about the way you made money, the more you'll be
There's skepticism.
And when you move that into the tech space, which is naturally an industry in which it's more difficult, it's more like, you know, paper returns, but it's more difficult to quantify that, well, that adds to the double guessing and so on and so forth. So in my main point here is what needs to happen is the shifting of the models. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be an acceptance and a lot of respect for what's been built, right, by certain families and tradition and so on, which has been the, you know, the reason why Europe has grown to where it grew. But at the same time, there is going to be a natural kind of like generational shift towards new areas. The most important thing is realizing and betting on what these new areas are, which is basically what we're trying to do when we think about, you know, data and data sovereignty and kind of like thinking about Europe can be a leader in that space. Or when you think about other places like Industry 4.0, manufacturing, when you think about climate tech and deep tech, there will be basically some areas in which Europe will be able to drive successes and
In the same way, say that London has been a driver of fintech.
Absolutely, for example, yeah. Absolutely. And that will drive, you know, kind of like creation of wealth and so on. And hopefully the generational kind of like transition will also come with less social envy for the success and the creation of those models that are necessary.
Yeah. I always joke, rightly or wrongly, that, you know, it always seems to me quite sad that private equity was invented in Italy and yet venture capital like doesn't hardly exist. I mean, it's starting to come up, and I think, you know, you mentioned Italian Tech Week is coming up in Turin, but you know, we're seeing more happening in Milan, Florence. You know, there's some hubs being built in various places. I'm very excited to see kind of where that goes. I think, you know, I have lots of these conversations in Italy with people, because Italy, actually, in terms of the strength of the academic system, is one of the strongest in Europe. Graduates from Italy are like super, you know, super well qualified. The problem is then the opportunity in Italy hasn't been there, and therefore they head off to the US, the UK, various other places, you know, to find. And I think the other thing, and we don't necessarily need to get into this, but in Europe more generally, because it's typically been a quite socialist in its politics overall, is the labor laws aren't conducive to building a startup. Because, you know, in Italy, for example, when you've got to build a startup, you hire a person, and you've got to pay into their, you know, into their, it's not even a pension. I couldn't figure it out when I the first time I worked with an Italian business. Like, why are we, what is this on the balance sheet that's like doing this weird stuff? And it was like, oh, okay, so we got to pay for, in case they're made redundant in the future, we have to have a pot of money that, you know, that they keep funding, or whatever it is today. But whether it's France, whether it's Italy, that, you know, one of the key kind of requirements in any startup is being flexible and, you know, being able to hire and fire people relatively quickly. I'm not saying that in a negative way.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not an advocate for, you know, very loose zero contract kind of, 0-hour contract type work, but what I mean is, you need to have that mobility of labor in the same way that you have the mobility of capital, so that you can scale up and down as you need.
To kick off the process, you have to, because when you think about what it means to build a company, the way I think about that is going beyond certain constraints. So what creates, you know, value in a company is when you actually find one part of the company where spikes are created, and spikes are created under pressure and under constraints, and going out, you know, and basically reverting that to make it a strength. So when you create boundaries that are non-competitive with other ecosystems, then you're basically putting in rules of the game that don't allow you to be successful. So the other day, just to give you an example, I was talking to a founder in our portfolio that was, I mean, I helped him in my previous experiences setting up engineering teams and doing performance reviews and so on and so forth. And we were talking about managing bonuses for engineers, or managing, you know, all of that. And the reason for that was actually that, for example, in Italy, you have to pay extra hours of work.
Yeah.
But when it comes to engineering, it's not easy, right?
Because everything's extra hours.
Because, yeah. But even like in terms of building a company by itself, everything is like under specific constraints.
It's not 9 to 5.
That. That doesn't mean that you have to overwork your employees. I'm not definitely, you know, pushing that. But what I mean is there are some tensions that are only kind of like creating obstacles to wealth creation and value generation. And so when you think about ecosystems, you're thinking about playing by different rules that kind of like hinder the growth of that ecosystem, right? So when I think about building companies and so on in Italy, going back to your point regarding the deep tech, so the value of academia and so on, all of that needs to be captured in a way that makes these people easily, that makes these people kind of like able to spin off and test with the market easily what they're building. Because it's the only way they can actually see value in all of that, right? If the more you privilege the technical set of things, the less you privilege the actual business set of things. There needs to be that push, you know? And to be honest with you, what I'm seeing is, and I need to be positive on that, there is for sure much more acceptance of that and trying to, you know, to actually push that. We have universities in Italy now that we partner with and so on that are pushing for that. Mm. Although it's true that you can't really teach entrepreneurship, right?
No.
And this is the big thing, right? But for sure, when it comes to competitive advantage, it's true that in Italy, the theory, right, is always preferred to the point where it's difficult to build companies, but it's very easy to actually have amazing ideas.
Yeah, so you can have incredible breakthroughs, but no route to commercialization because you haven't got the entrepreneurial.
Yeah. So for us, most of the work that we do with founders in Italy is kind of like converting that incredible talent when it comes to theory into practice. Yep. And it's I mean, the quality is incredible.
Yeah. And the, I mean, again, just to kind of round that off, I guess, this is where I'm seeing Europe as shifting in a direction that might make it even harder for itself, right? So you have Meloni in Italy, you've had the AfD now win some sort of regional elections in Germany. We obviously had the slight rise of reform here in the UK, albeit that, you know, Labour won their majority. You have Le Pen in France, etc. And a lot of that is about a lot of what's been driving that is migration, right? Mm-hmm. As an example, and forgetting the politics of that for a second, right? Migration typically is a net sort of positive driver to economies, and we see that, you know, 60% of startups are founded typically by migrants, right? What I wouldn't want to see in Europe is migration being slowed down to the extent that you can't import that entrepreneurial talent, right? Because mm-hmm. what you want, and you know, this is one of the problems for me with Brexit, that lack of free movement of labor now in the UK just means that it hinders the ability for that cross-functional kind mm-hmm. of experimentation and transfer of skills. And to your point, you know, if I were sitting in charge of Italy right now, don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, you know, I would try and find a way of unlocking that latent potential of the mm-hmm. scientific theoretical by layering in kind of the entrepreneurial talent. So I would, you know, I would open up entrepreneurial visas, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera, bring in that talent, set up hubs. I think France has done a bit of this as well, yeah. And pour some capital into that, because I think from there you'd see, you know, some expansion. We had, you know, we've had people on the podcast before, had Antonio Avitabile from Sony Innovation Ventures. And, you know, he mentioned to me that there was a hub being built in Pisa, or a manufacturing mm-hmm. hub being built in Pisa for vision sensors, for sensors, right? Like, I've been to Pisa many, many times. It would not have struck me that that is a place you're going to build that sort of a hub. But if those things happen, I always say where capital flows, talent will flow, right? Yeah. So the more, you know, and vice versa, right? Where talent flows, capital will flow as well. So it tends to be kind of a positive reinforcing circle. So fingers crossed, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's when we were designing 2100, we actually jotted down a few thoughts and so on. And we had this exercise in which we were kind of like going out and writing things on a whiteboard about things that we wanted to see, basically. One thing that came out multiple times and in iteration is the concept of breaking down barriers, right? And the thing about this is we think of this in terms of flywheels, or personally, I think of it in terms of flywheels. Flywheels are good because they create cross-pollination. So the more you are tactical and strategic about the way you create flywheels, the more you can generate value. So one flywheel that needs to happen naturally, and it doesn't need to be stopped, which speaks about what we're talking about, is basically that of making sure that the Italian founders, for example, if you want to focus on Italian founders, can see how Italian founders abroad are building things.
Yeah.
Because the Italian founders abroad, and I was one of them, the fact that they don't naturally find themselves in communities allows them to be part of multiple communities at the same time. And even when it comes to founding teams, what we observed is Italians don't want to do companies with other Italians per se, but they actually want to build with other nationalities and other groups of people, because we don't feel that kind of like, you know, natural, you know, we don't look for the other Italian at a party. We go out and talk to everybody. That's the way we're wired. But so that's one thing. So the first flywheel is you need to show to them what it means to build something out, to understand two things. One is the privilege of being able to build in your country, which is a massive thing. And the second thing is what it takes in terms of, if you are a top 5% startup in Italy, you're probably top 80% company outside of Italy.
Right.
So you need to appreciate that relativity of ecosystems is a very important concept. And the second flywheel, or the third group that we want to engage, is European founders. Because the moment you remove the component of nationality, which comes from cultural framework, the more you are cross-pollinated with other cultures. And that is where, when we do investments that are completely unrelated to Southern Europe, completely unrelated to Italy, and we have a lot of them, actually more than 50% of the portfolio, it's a thesis-driven type of approach. It's more like to back kind of like European founders and so on. When we actually see how they're working, we can translate and kind of like show also to founders building in Italy or abroad,
this is
how it's done, right? We have companies that are, you know, among the top 1% of companies in terms of growth right now in Europe in the portfolio. And seeing these founders, even having the privilege of learning from them and being able to show to other companies in my portfolio how these guys are doing things, they have no relation whatsoever to Europe. They have no relation whatsoever to Italy and so on and so forth. So they are completely pure in the way they do things. They just tell you how things need to be done. And it's great to create these two flywheels because that's how value is generated. Mm. That's also why sometimes I'm a bit skeptical about geographic funds unless there is an ecosystem there that can be built, right? And I'm very respectful of those who have done it in France, for example, and so on. But you need to be mindful of the supply, but also of the demand of the country towards that. And I think when it comes to Italy, unless something happens, just like you said, across the board, that means government, that means society, and we have a duty and we want to help society also change the stance towards that. But unless all of that happens, then you don't create that flow. Mm. And so it's difficult to actually, I mean, you're basically just reinvesting money that comes from a government through, you know, your CDP or whoever is actually the government fund into the ecosystem, but you're creating a closed loop.
Yeah.
Breaking that loop is what creates value, essentially, in my view. But I know I am, you know.
No, I mean, look.
It's just my personal kind of like stance on this.
I love talking about this stuff because I think, you know, there's a lot of the, you know, I don't know where it's gone now, but, you know, there was a lot of this sort of acceleration, European acceleration. Mm-hmm. You had Andreas
Klinger
talking about that a great deal. And that seems sort of like now maybe it hasn't died. Maybe they're actually going out and trying to do stuff. But yeah, and one of the main things then, it's to your point around flywheels and breaking down those sort of barriers, you know, the two things that he has suggested is one, have an EU limited, i.e., you know, one company structure for across Europe. So don't have to, you know, go to Germany to set up GmbH or whatever it is. Don't have to go to Italy to set up an SPR. But you have this one common structure, which makes it easier for investors to answer, similar to Delaware kind of Inc. Yeah. The second thing he said was, you know, everyone should speak English. Like that is, you know, I'm a linguist. I speak several languages. But ultimately, if you want to get by, certainly within the tech ecosystem, at some point you are going to have to work with certainly US English-speaking investors, right? Like even if you're in Europe, and quite frankly, to build your business to the sort of scale that most likely is going to lead to a massive outcome, you are probably going to have to run your business to some extent in the US, right?
So which is why I don't like to think of. We have to do it because that's the natural thing and it's local bias and so on. But I never think in terms of Italian founders.
Yeah.
And I don't even like too much the fact that when we talk about 2100, for example, there's that concept of Italian founders abroad and so on. The way I think about that is we are European founders. Mm. That's it. That's the framework. And I totally agree with Andreas on EU Limited. I actually have mentors, so GPs of successful funds, that tell me whenever you meet a founder that has your same nationality, speak to them in English.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. Now, don't speak to them in Italian because the moment you create that level of, not confidence, but the level of comfort, you never test them on their ability to scale.
Yeah.
And this is something that is stuck to my mind. And she keeps doing that to founders.
Put them out of their comfort zone so that they
test them as European founders, right? So if I meet a founder that doesn't speak English, unless they have an amazing company that are building and I basically discount that, right? And I still want to invest, then it's for sure. But otherwise, it's just like you said, right? it's English market, right? It's basically, you know, it's an English speaking market that you're going to be operating in if you scale. If you don't, then it's fine. But, you know, it's so these two things are super important. It's European founders. The way I think about myself is I'm European, and for sure I have an Italian passport and I love my country and so on and so forth. But I live in England. I've been living in England for 14 years now, probably almost kind of like, you know, half of my life by now. But so I don't necessarily, this is why Brexit for me was like a massive shock. And to date, I still don't accept it. But it's, but I mean,
whole another podcast on that, for sure.
Exactly. But it's basically how I think about stuff. Yeah. And to founders, that is pretty reflected when we actually pitch the fund and when I think about investing.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting. So look, you founded 2100 Ventures to build a European emerging manager led fund to power a sustainable European evolution. We just talked a lot about that, but talk me through where you see the ecosystem actually heading, and given some of your LP base, what changes in attitude do you think we need to see in order to unlock the next level of venture and growth in Europe? So, you know, we've talked about some of those systemic problems to create that stronger platform for founders and entrepreneurs to build in Europe. But how do we get from there to really the sort of explosive growth we all hope we will see in Europe?
So there's a few points about this. I think I'm always a proponent of appreciation of the cultural component of ecosystems, right? And when I think about Europe, it's true that the European ecosystem, when we think about, you know, comparing that to other places and so on, like, or comparing that to other markets like China.
I never think it's value. Like, it really annoys me where in the UK, like previously we had the Chancellor saying we aim to be the next Silicon Valley.
Yeah, exactly.
I just don't think that's a very useful.
Yeah, I think there's actually little to no point to imitate in general, right? Yeah. So for me, it's not a matter of like imitating other places, because they will always have competitive advantage or...
And they've been doing it longer.
Exactly. Or idiosyncrasies that make that place unique. So there's no point in trying to recreate a system when I'm a big fan of system thinking, but you never have two systems that are exactly the same. And so there's no point in trying to recreate that. So going back to the basics of Europe, essentially, there is for sure a thesis that we keep on essentially iterating on and so on. But there's for sure a component of Europe that is undergoing natural shifts and reforms that are structurally necessary to remain competitive, not in the same places, not in the same industries, maybe, than China and the US, but for sure it will have to be there. So when we actually started for this fund to identify the key themes that we observe, and these are also reflected in the portfolio that we are building, we saw essentially three main areas that will be driving that. And we discussed that briefly before. But on one hand, Europe will always be driven by businesses. Mm-hmm. Something that other countries have not been driven by, for structural reasons. But if there's one thing that Europe has built back in the past, is companies and kind of like innovation and so on. Now that has slowed down due to regulation and multiple things and probably unfair competition from outside. But naturally there is a spirit of building things that has always been there in Europe and always will be there. So the first thing is going back to the basics and observing how these companies are built. Right. When you look at the major companies being built in Italy in the past, in Germany, in France, and so on, there are massive opportunities there that need to be captured. So one part of it is for sure a thesis that go around, can we actually innovate that what is called old economy? The way we do this is basically learning from, the main LP that we have for this fund, the Benetton family, who has been innovating and building a huge network of companies over the last 50, 60 years.
And all we really see, I mean, the only context I have of Benetton is the clothes.
But they
do much more than that.
Actually, that is like a small part of the full spectrum of activities of the family. But regardless of their kind of like work that they've done, which is impressive and so on, we literally are learning how to build kind of like enterprise, you know, like how to build that kind of like system. And you can scale that, because when you actually go and look at the infrastructure of that, there's innovators all across Europe, right? The way they've built that was essentially identifying something which was unique and then building on top of that. Mm. So one part of this, of the thesis that we have on the sustainable industrial revolution, is essentially going back to the basics of manufacturing, what made kind of like the part of Europe actually huge. So as I was saying, the whole kind of like shifting of the industry towards Industry 4.0, how companies and processes are rebuilt into factories and so on. So making things much more productive, which is something that Europe has lost over the last 20 years, is productivity. Mm-hmm. So that is one aspect that, by learning from, you know, who's done it and who keeps innovating, we can basically create that kind of like connection. Then there is a second kind of like pillar that we have, which is the climate tech and the Green Deal in Europe, that will naturally try to close the gap with, you know, in competitiveness with our ecosystems. And that speaks about climate tech and deep tech. When you speak about deep tech, you will be surprised by the number of incredible founders that we see in the deep tech space across Europe. And it's honestly impressive to see them kind of like building, in some cases, unicorns out of these technologies. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about nuclear. I'm talking about chips manufacturing. I'm talking about things that are not obvious. But when you actually go and look into that, it's a massive, massive industry. So that is another thing where Europe has a potential, because it draws, just like you said, from the university and the history and the cultural aspect of that. And then the third bit is data and financial services, which is the area where I'm mostly focused on. And there, honestly, the opportunity is massive, because there's for sure a component of data sovereignty. So there's for sure a component of Europe not wanting to be left behind over other ecosystems about the way data has been shared. The moment your data is not in your kind of like soil, then, well, you're basically depending on other. Yeah, exactly. And for sure, we're seeing a lot of tailwinds now when it comes to companies building in that space. Infrastructurally, you can find companies like UiPath and others that have built massive global plays out of that kind of like pressure and constraint, right? You listen to the story of UiPath, and it's a story of building under pressure and building a global business. So I still think that there's value in building out of Europe for this type of businesses, because there's a natural advantage in terms of talent and potential scalability. You can build now from decentralization of talent, so you can build companies outside of you know, basically out of Europe with incredible talent. Mm. Same goes for financial services, where I think the UK naturally is the best place and the place where I see most of the companies being built. But naturally, I think, you know, in some parts of financial services, Europe is actually a bit more advanced than the US.
It's starting to change.
US.
And I think, again, post-Brexit, it's probably changed further as well. Yeah.
No, I think it's... So this is kind of like the overarching kind of like thesis of that growth of Europe that will be driven by these three pillars. And basically, you know, the way we actually do these investments is kind of like creating smaller theses on these topics and find companies that are building that space and seeing, you know, and enabling them, you know, to actually talk to the old economy, which is a massive thing and something which is very difficult, because innovation at corporate level is still, you know, a big topic to discuss. But I think naturally will happen. So it's just a matter of like pushing that agenda.
I think it's exciting. I mean, I think... Yeah, I'm never going to be one to say that we have everything right, whether in the UK or in Europe. But I see lots of positives happening, and, you know, positives that have happened and continue to happen. And I think, you know, that they're, to your point around climate, deep tech, etc. You know, I think part of the push towards sovereignty and security, whether that's food security, defense, etc. I think some of those issues, you know, the war on the kind of Eastern Front has to some extent pushed that agenda forward, you know, amongst other things. You know, the supply chain disruption, your energy disruption, all of these sort of things have forced Europe to an extent to wake up and say, well, okay, maybe we need to do some, you know, something about this. I think the other thing that's interesting as well is, and I think about this quite a lot, is, you know, if you go on Twitter, X, everyone rails against regulation, right? And European regulation. However, to some extent, that European regulation benefits European startups that then are able to build within that framework, right? Yeah. And protects Europe from some of the egresses and the excesses of some of the larger tech companies. So I think there's a balance. I don't think anything should be overly regulated ever, obviously. That's problematic. But I think it actually provides the guardrails such that you don't have, you don't have a situation where things essentially, become outside of your control, right?
There's a natural tendency, I think, from VCs for absolutism in everything, right?
Yeah. No nuance.
exactly. So everything needs to be absolute, right, when you talk about VC. And the other thing is we are talking about a culture, the VC culture, that has been imported by other systems, right? So when you read people that are, thought leaders in VC, I would say most of them, maybe because they shout more or maybe because they're more opinionated about stuff because of that culture, they come from the US. So they naturally have, a platform for propaganda of their ideas that kind of like hits you, right? Because you read stuff and you're like, wow, I mean, we're being left behind and so on and so forth. And I think there is for sure a component of, natural competition where, you basically play by different rules. And then the other thing is the cultural bit. But when you look at cultures, I'm very mindful and respectful of the fact that the American culture has been able to build the VC industry, right, for sure.
But they started 40 years earlier than...
They started 40 years old. And also, there's pros and cons, right? So, in other areas, the American culture has gone wrong. Mm. And Europe is much better, right? For all the people that from Europe moved to the US, of course, generalizing this, but... They were shocked by what they saw in the US in terms of culture, right? Especially right now. You have to take the good and the bad about certain things and weigh them by that, right? And so, I think Europe has done a lot. It's just behind because it's behind on technological challenges. There are the technological challenges of these years. But I mean, it's just a matter of what it is. You can make this your advantage if you build another.
You could either take the negative path where we're behind, so there's no point starting, or you start and you build from here.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So Andrea, look, I mean, it's been absolutely great talking about all of this, but I have one final question for you. What is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction on from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is a hill that you would die on defending, although we just talked about that absolutism, so maybe that's your contrarian advice, but is one thing
we always joke with my friends that I'm the one who doesn't take like strong views on things, so they always make fun of me for that, so I'm always kind of like in the middle of topics, so I don't have contrarian views, but for sure what I think is that there is a natural, like, most of the times, if you go back to the way people are thinking about things, I think it's most important to judge the reasoning than the output of all of this. So it's not really a contrarian view, but what I would say is there are many nuances to things that honestly allow you to be a bit more multimodal in the way you think about stuff. So I think most of the times you try to jump to the conclusion. But I would use this metaphor. So one of the reasons why we invested in this AI company that I was talking to about, Prometheus, is that it was building a reasoning engine, right, for AI. And when I think about AI, I always feel much more interested in the way the model came to a certain answer
than what it actually does.
Than the actual answer. And I think most of the people think a lot about the output, but don't think too much about the reasoning behind all of this. So I would say that's one view where, like, most of the times I don't get much kind of like recognition, or where basically I get a lot of pushback in saying, look at, what's happening, and this is, this is wrong, right?
Yeah.
Think a bit more about the whys and why that, is.
I couldn't agree. I mean, I had a conversation with someone, I think he was giving a talk, and, he said, we need to move away from thinking about, what we have today is artificial knowledge rather than artificial intelligence. Or it was something along those lines, but it was like knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Intelligence is knowing not to put it in your fruit salad. It was something like that. I probably just butchered it, but I agree. I mean, like, sometimes you've got to figure out what's sitting behind rather than what you see, right? And I think that that probably applies to a huge number of areas of life, to be honest, yeah. right? But look, Andrea, it's been absolutely incredible having you in the studio with me today.
Thanks
I really
so much.
Appreciate the conversation.
Likewise.
For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where
I'm on LinkedIn, so absolutely. And I reply to most of the messages, so it's absolutely a great way to contact me. On the website of 2100, there's the email, but sure, I mean, any of the two are a great way to contact me, and I'm super happy to talk to people, so it's a great match.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I really appreciate
your
time.
Thanks so much, Arish. Thank you.